Well, welcome to Brettonomics, a podcast series brought to you by the Bretton Woods Committee. I'm Nancy Jacklin, and I'm hosting this series about the institutions created for cooperation in international monetary and economic affairs. During this segment of the series, we've been discussing institutions for international cooperation and economic development, starting with the World Bank, created at the historic Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. Before looking at this preeminent multilateral development bank, we began with a podcast that provided the broad theoretical and practical framework for development assistance and finance. Today, and in the next podcast, we're going to explore another part of that ecosystem, namely multilateral development banks that have a more regional membership and focus, the so-called RDBs. There are around 30 RDBs in existence today, and several have substantial resources, but we can't possibly explore all of them here. We'll focus on four, which were patterned in many but not all respects on the World Bank. All use its financial model, for example, and they've been called by some the legacy RDBs. Over time, each one included not only member countries of the relevant geographic region, but also non-regional members. These are also institutions with a fair amount of overlapping membership with the IMF and World Bank, and which cooperate from time to time on issues or problems of common concern. We'll talk about some of those areas of cooperation. These RDBs and the order in which they were established are the Inter-American Development Bank, the African Development Bank and its sister institution, the African Development Fund, the Asian Development Bank, and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. We'll learn why each was created, how they evolved over the years. We'll also discuss the two newest MDBs, the New Development Bank and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, to understand why they were created and how they're similar to and differ from some of the legacy RDBs. Today, our focus is going to be on three RDBs, the Inter-American Development Bank, the African Development Bank, and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. My guest today is Nancy Lee, who is currently Director for Sustainable Development Finance at the Center for Global Development, as well as a Senior Advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Nancy has a broad and deep experience in development economics and finance, including the role of the RDBs in that ecosystem. She started her career at the U.S. Treasury and rose to become the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Western Hemisphere, but also served in that role for a time for Europe and Eurasia. After her service at the U.S. Treasury, she became the Deputy Chief Executive Officer at the Millennium Challenge Corporation, an innovative U.S. aid agency. Most relevant to our podcast today, Nancy was the Chief Executive Officer of the Multilateral Investment Fund at the Inter-American Development Bank, the bank's laboratory for private sector-led development and an impact investor in the region. Thank you so much, Nancy, for taking the time to share your deep knowledge and policy experience with us today.
Thanks, Nancy. I'm really glad to be able to join this really important conversation.
That's great. Well, let's dive right into some of the questions. So let's start with the Inter-American Development Bank, the IDB. It was created in 1959, but the idea of a regional development bank, I was surprised that for Latin America, dates back to 1933 or earlier. It was a project in the Roosevelt administration. So tell us how it finally came about and why the Latin American region thought this additional institution was needed even after the World Bank was established.
Well, let's remember that the whole idea of a multilateral development bank capitalized by government shareholders was still a pretty radical idea in the late 50s. The World Bank was only 13 years old, but shareholders were beginning to see its value. They liked the notion that their capital contributions, which after all came out of their aid budgets, could be multiplied and leveraged many times over. And they saw that the loans the World Bank was making were being repaid. That was not obvious to many at the beginning that this would be the case. So the example of the World Bank showed that the model works. It was logical then to create the same sort of bank for Latin America and the Caribbean. The U.S. under President Eisenhower wanted a bank focused on shoring up its neighboring region at a time when there were strong Cold War concerns about spreading communist influence. And the countries of the region, for their part, wanted a bank where their voice and vote played a significant role in its governance.
So in what way, what key ways does the IDB differ from the World Bank?
I would highlight four differences. First, the countries of the region that borrow from the bank own more than 50% of the capital shares, which is not the case with the World Bank. They view it as a cooperative bank. This enhances their sense of trust and confidence that the bank will be responsive to their needs. But at the same time, the IDB maintains a AAA rating and operates with very strong prudential standards. So the ownership structure has not undermined those standards. Second, the IDB's president has, with one brief exception, been from the region itself, the borrowing region, and the management and the staff are mostly from the region. So the culture of the bank is well aligned with its clients. The local bank representatives are well regarded and have strong relationships with both governments and private partners. And my own experience working inside the bank is that its staff are both highly competent and highly motivated.
Yeah, you've expressed well the key differences that really apply between the RDBs generally and the World Bank. The RDBs are much more directly representative of the regions they serve. I note, however, that the non-regional members are important in terms of their funding support and helping to create and maintain market confidence in their operations, a topic we discussed at some length when we had our podcasts on the World Bank. Indeed, the U.S. has a 30% share in the IDB and Canada a 4% share. And of the 48 members, 26 are in Latin America and the Caribbean. So, Nancy, please proceed and tell us some of the other key differences between the IDB and the World Bank.
I think the bank has taken up some of the most important innovations emerging from within the region itself, and it's facilitated their spread to other countries. A good example is cash transfers, including conditional cash transfers, pioneered by Mexico, then Brazil, and taken up by others across the region and beyond the rest of the world. Cash transfers are payments to poor households, either conditioned on certain actions like making sure their kids go to school or they're immunized or not. The evidence on cash transfers is that they have a significant and sustained impact on reducing poverty. That's exactly what a multilateral development bank should do and what domestic development institutions are less well placed to do. That is, take a good idea and help other countries adopt it. One last difference we're seeing emerging now is the IDB's approach to mobilization of private finance. It, like the World Bank, has a separate private finance arm called IDB Invest. IDB Invest has been at the forefront of transforming its strategy from a focus on the volume of its own finance to a focus on mobilizing private finance at scale. That's a major change, and it responds to the reality that MDBs need to be more catalytic to unlock private finance. As a result, shareholders have just agreed to give it a capital increase, which is no easy feat in today's political environment. One hopes that other MDBs will take notice and take up IDB Invest's reforms.
Yeah, well, you were very involved at the IDB and the private sector role in development, managing the bank's multilateral investment fund. And the IDB now has what it calls IDB Invest, as you said, which is like the IFC at the World Bank, but it also has the IDB Lab. Can you tell us what that does?
Yeah, the IDB Lab, which was formerly the Multilateral Investment Fund, is a unique and valuable asset for the IDB. No other MDB has one. The lab that was recently created at the World Bank is different. That appears to have more of an advisory role than a financing role. So the IDB Lab is focused on finding scalable innovations with high potential development and climate impact. That means it's prepared to take early stage risk, and it can deploy a suite of tools to do so: grants, reimbursable grants, equity, first loss, and subordinated debt. That's enormously beneficial in filling critical capital market gaps, including the notorious valley of death when firms fail as they're starved of finance as they try to grow enough to reach profitability. When I was at the lab, some of our most important investments were in building local capital markets, venture capital funds, and transforming microfinance institutions into deposit-taking banks that serve small and medium enterprises. We also have the capacity to pilot business model innovations that solve some of the problems of doing business in low-income environments. We tested, for example, new and innovative credit scoring methodologies that make it possible to lend efficiently and profitably to excluded populations like women. These new models were based on big data analysis for psychometric testing, not collateral, which disadvantages women entrepreneurs that tend to own less collateral. We helped the region pioneer social impact bonds, which are now gaining traction. These are bonds issued to the private sector that help governance pay for the upfront costs of expensive social interventions like reducing recidivism in prison populations. In short, the lab's early stage risk-tolerant finance makes it possible to develop a high-impact project pipeline that then can be taken up and scaled by the rest of the bank. I've long thought every MVB needs such a lab, or they collectively need one that can serve as a system-wide asset. The lab is funded by a combination of donor contributions and the returns on its own lending and equity investments. I was really pleased to see agreement reached at the IDB's annual meetings this month to set a target of adding $400 million to the lab's finance capacity. That really shows shareholder confidence in its worth.
Yeah, that's a great innovative tool, and it's fascinating to hear how it's evolving over time. Now, in our podcast discussing the World Bank Group, we spoke of the importance being placed today on the MDBs helping their members mitigate and adapt to climate change within the context of fostering sustainable development. The World Bank's doing that through lending activities, advisory activities, and its knowledge bank, and via management of specialized trust funds, as we learned in the earlier podcasts. Tell me how the IDB is engaging in this important work.
The IDB is also clearly committed to boosting its climate mitigation and adaptation role. President Goldfein has made that really very clear from the start of his tenure. And it makes a lot of sense. The region is well endowed with natural capital and renewable energy generation capacity that can benefit its own economies as well as the world's. Shareholders just agreed to a new institutional strategy at the annual meetings that clearly defines addressing climate change as part of its mandate, along with reducing poverty and inequality and bolstering sustainable regional growth. I think the strategy is right to highlight growth. The region has long been weighed down by low productivity and low growth, its tight fiscal constraints, lagging social indicators, and social disharmony are a constant. I was also pleased to see the strong focus on gender in the institutional strategy. Gender will be a focus area in its own right, and it'll be a cross-cutting priority integrated into all seven of the bank's focus areas.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the importance of focusing on gender issues and economic development. That was done, too, in our podcasts on the World Bank. I mean, we all know the Spanish word machismo. And that characteristic's not unique to Latin America, I'm afraid. It's common in lots of continents. But I think today it's generally recognized that education of women and their full integration into the economy can be a key driver of economic growth. And some countries have a bit more catching up to do than others. I thought with the two of us doing this podcast, we ought to make a pitch for gender education and integration. So now tell me, what kinds of things is the IDB doing on climate change?
Broadly, the bank deploys the same kinds of tools as the list you mentioned for the World Bank. But let me highlight four areas where the IDB is playing, I would say, a pioneering role. First step for nature swaps, like Ecuador's Galapagos bond. The proceeds of this sovereign bond issued by Ecuador, with a guarantee from the IDB that sharply reduced its interest rate, will be used for protecting the ecosystem and biodiversity in the Galapagos Islands. So a very scalable way to promote climate change adaptation and mitigation. The second is deploying climate resilient debt clauses in the IDB's own loan. And those clauses pause payments for countries hit by natural disasters. The third is a really new innovation called IDB Clima, which is an innovative approach that rewards countries committed to significant climate and nature-related investments. The reward is provided in the form of a grant in the amount of 5% of the loan principal for eligible countries. Eligibility depends on whether nature and climate objectives of selected project loans are met. So we'll see how that works as a way to incentivize climate-related investments. And then finally, the IDB is also working with the African Development Bank on developing an approach that allows SDR holders, those assets that are issued by the IMF, and to use their SDRs to purchase hybrid capital bonds from MDBs. Those bonds then can be leveraged in lending capacity. So it's a way to channel SDRs through the MDB system for development and climate finance.
So these are all, as you said, interesting ideas and innovations and attempts to find various solutions to financing the costs of climate adaptation and climate mitigation. And it'll be fascinating to see how they evolve and which ones kind of take off more than others. So, well, we learned in our earlier podcasts about the important role the IMF plays in resolving sovereign debt crises. Right, they design an economic adjustment program with a country in crisis so it can restore a sustainable balance of payments position. The IMF provides its own short-term balance of payments financing to support that economic adjustment. But it also defines the size of the debtor country's overall financing needs in order to support the program beyond what the IMF can provide. The so-called financing gap is often filled in part by private and public sector creditors of the country, often by restructuring or forgiving the country's outstanding debts to them. Financing typically is also provided by the MDBs, the World Bank, and the relevant RDBs. In the 1980s, as we know, many of the distressed sovereign debtors were countries in Latin America, such as Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Venezuela, Ecuador, Peru, and others. They were engaged in a decade-long period of restructurings and economic adjustment programs, and the period is often called their lost decade. Can you tell us what the IDB did during this period in the way of helping to fill the financing gap and otherwise support its members in adjustment toward a path of sustainable growth?
Yeah, the IDB did play a major role in helping to fill finance gaps in those tough periods of debt crisis and debt distress for the region.
Yeah, I had read the first year the IDB actually reached $3 billion in its lending was in 1983, in those early years of the sovereign debt crisis.
Yeah, countries in trouble definitely turn to the bank. And I must say that in my experience at the U.S. Treasury, successive administrations also turn to the bank to step up support for IMF programs designed to help countries restore debt sustainability. Not all those programs succeeded, as you well know, but the bank played a crucial role in the ones that did. I'd cite Uruguay in the 2000s as an example that I know well, where responsible government, the IMF, the IDB, and private creditors all, by and large, work together to restore debt sustainability and growth. The IMF cannot move forward with its own financing unless finance gaps identified under its programs are filled, partly in some cases by debt restructuring, but also by new finance. And so for the system to work, MDBs have to be a key source of that new finance.
Yeah, and in our earlier podcasts, we discussed the high current levels of debt distress, especially in some of the low-income countries after the experience of the economic shock of COVID. So I totally agree that the cooperation among the IMF and all the MDBs learned in prior crises needs to be focused on today in this new context. Well, let's move on to another one of the RDBs, the African Development Bank and Fund. This is a relatively small RDB, although Africa will account for 11 of the world's 20 fastest growing economies in 2024. And the region's overall growth in GDP for 24 and 25 is projected to be higher than the global average. So this is a dynamic and growing continent in terms of economic importance. The African Development Bank and African Development Fund created in 1963 and 1973, respectively. Can you tell me about their membership?
Yeah, the African Development Bank is another institution which is greatly valued by its borrowing country members. Its shareholding structure is also different from the World Bank's. Borrowing countries from Africa hold 60% of its shares, and its non-borrowing shareholder structure is relatively fragmented. The U.S., Japan, Germany, France each hold less than 7% of shares. So that structure has the advantage of regional control, but the disadvantage of lacking a few large, rich country champions that can drive capital increases and grants for its concessional window, the African Development Fund.
So what today are the priorities the bank's currently focused on?
The African Development Bank defines what they call the high fives, which are Light Up and Power Africa, Feed Africa, Industrialize Africa, Integrate Africa, and Improve the Quality of Life for the People of Africa. So climate runs through all of those, especially adaptation and resilience. We know that Africa is home to much biodiversity and huge emissions, absorbing forests, but also to many of the countries that are most vulnerable to climate change. It also has the world's highest extreme poverty rates, with 23 of the world's 28 poorest countries. So you can make a strong case that the African Development Bank is too small. It is chronically capital constrained, and the African Development Fund, its concessional window, is tiny compared to the World Bank's concessional window called IDA.
Yeah. As you say, it's the smallest of the legacy RDBs, but Africa is the region with the greatest needs, but also the greatest growth potential. Now, it's been quite creative in recent years in its operations. Can you talk about some of that?
Yeah, I see a disconnect between, on the one hand, its performance and the needs of its region, and on the other hand, its size. Our research at the Center for Global Development shows that it's a leader and pioneer in certain significant areas. For example, it is the largest source of MDB finance for public-private infrastructure in sub-Saharan Africa. It has the largest share of regional and regional integration projects of any multilateral development bank. A larger share of its finance is climate-related than the World Bank's share, 43% versus 30%, 36% at the moment. It has the strongest, most comprehensive, most transparent corporate scorecard of any major MDB, according to research that we just published. It uses its capital efficiently. It's pioneered the largest transfers of portfolio risk to the private sector, which frees up capital for more lending of any of the multilateral development banks. This is what people refer to as the originate to distribute model.
Yeah, that's been done for years in commercial banks, which is a way to deal with their capital requirements. But, they originate the loans and then try to sell them off through one financial instrument or another. So, yeah.
And I think you can see that since the African Development Bank has been capital constrained, it has been among the most innovative, if not the most innovative, of the banks in using its capital, the capital yeah. that it has more efficiently.
Yeah.
It's also leading the charge on creating a workable means of using SDRs for shareholder purchases of hybrid capital, something which has great potential to recycle SDRs to the countries that most need them, as I was mentioning before in the IDB context. Mm-hmm. But it also just launched the first major hybrid capital issuance to private investors of any major multilateral development bank. That issuance was 8 times oversubscribed, which gives you a sense of the level of interest of private investors in having part of the capital of these institutions in a way which does not change the mission or the governance of the institutions. Hybrid capital is a non-voting asset. So I'd encourage shareholders and others not to focus only on the biggest institutions, both when they're thinking about allocating resources and when they're looking for best practice.
Yeah, it's really quite an amazing change over the years. I mean, I remember the early days when the African Development Bank, at one point when there was social unrest, major civil unrest in the Ivory Coast, when it couldn't even occupy their offices in Abidjan. So this is a great story that you're telling it. Now let's move on to the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Though it was created after the Asian Development Bank, I want to go a little bit out of chronological order and talk next about the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development created in 1991. European Union members and the European Investment Bank have a majority of the shares. The EBRD has 69 members, and its borrower members have only 14% of the voting power. So that's quite different from the African Development Bank. It's kind of at the other end of the spectrum. The EBRD differs a lot from the World Bank and the other RDBs. Can you tell us first what the motivation was to establish the bank and how it was unique in terms of its having an explicit political role and mandate and its focus on the private sector?
Yeah, the EBRD was expressly created to help former communist countries build market democracies. So that's why most of its business, unlike the other banks, is financing private sector development rather than financing governments. And that's why it alone has a commitment to democracy as part of its charter. The charter specifies that the bank may conduct its operations, which not only are proceeding in the country's transition toward market-oriented economies, but also are applying principles of multi-party democracy and pluralism. Its original borrowing members were in Central Eastern Europe and Central Asia. Its aim was to foster economic transition. And it's fair to say that was originally viewed as a time-bound mission. So this would not be a bank that would have an indefinite lifespan. It measured its performance by indicators of transition impact, and those later actually became the model for the development impact indicators that are now used by the IFC at the World Bank. But over time, its advantages in private sector development were recognized, and its shareholders have expanded its regions of operations now to include Turkey and North African countries like Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, Lebanon, and the West Bank, Gaza, among others.
So what became the EBRD's real relative strengths in development finance and assistance? And obviously, this private sector is one of the areas.
I'd point to two distinctive EBRD strengths. One is financial sector development, and the other is municipal infrastructure. On the first, former communist countries, of course, had no private banks, and lending from the existing public banks was both politicized and very poorly allocated. So the EBRD focused heavily on building new banks, especially institutions that could lend profitably to small and medium enterprises, because, of course, the idea was to help new firms be established and grow. The U.S. was very much a partner in that effort. Part of U.S. assistance at that time went as grants where they were most needed to fund early stage risk and capacity building, beginning with the Russia Small Business Fund and then expanding into Central and Eastern Europe and Central Asia. U.S. grants funded first loss guarantees and training of loan officers to assess creditworthiness effectively and efficiently in an environment with no real capacity to either value or enforce claims on collateral. So new credit scoring models had to be developed. And that was a very effective and catalytic use of our aid dollars. Some of the most innovative European banks, like ProCredit Bank, were created in the process. Most of its longstanding relationships with Central and Eastern European banks allowed the EBRD to play a relatively strong countercyclical role later when the global financial crisis hit Europe especially hard. So it was labeled to lend to these trusted bank partners, refinance current loans or add to existing loans.
Yeah, so I was just going to remind our listeners that we had heard about this the European financial crisis when we were talking about the great financial crisis in 2008, 2009, and what followed. So the IMF was obviously very active, but so was the EBRD. So please proceed on municipal.
So on municipal infrastructure, EBRD has been a leader in what I would call decentralizing access to infrastructure finance. Its municipal infrastructure strategy targets green and sustainable finance for infrastructure in 100 cities, so it's pretty ambitious in terms of scale. It promotes local capacity in project tendering, project management, and regulatory reform to strengthen the investment climate for infrastructure investments, and it deploys sub-sovereign lending and innovative instruments like project bonds, green bonds, and mezzanine finance. So EBRD has been a pioneer, I would say ahead of other institutions, in sub-sovereign infrastructure finance. And that's important because building capital markets at the local level helps avoid excessive dependence on sovereign debt finance for infrastructure.
Right, for what are essentially domestic needs that aren't going to generate foreign exchange. So now in our podcast on the World Bank, we also heard about the importance of lending to subnational entities, where a lot of the important economic developments carried out, whether it's clean water, education, or healthcare needs. And in each case, though, the loan repayments guaranteed by the national banks as the institution's charters require. Now, around 2008, there was considerable debate about winding up the EBRD and declaring that mission accomplished. And as we learned in the previous podcast, and as you've just told us, after the great financial crisis occurred and the European financial crisis, the EBRD had a big job helping in the resolution of those. Then the Arab Spring occurred in 2010 and 2012 with some North African and Middle Eastern countries undergoing political and economic transitions, not so unlike what happened with the communist countries. So why did the EBRD assume a role in supporting those regions?
I think it was because shareholders recognized EBRD's leadership in private sector finance. And the need for a focus on private sector development in the Middle East and North Africa region. So it was the right institution for that region. And similarly, in sub-Saharan Africa, it has a comparative advantage in private finance, which is seen as complementing that of the African Development Bank, where private finance accounts for a relatively small share of the operation. So the synergies between the African Development Bank and the EBRD made a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's great. They're complementary. So another important thing the EBRD is doing today is helping address the economic challenges facing Ukraine. Can you comment on that a little?
Well, the war in Ukraine has greatly changed the EBRD's capital picture. The finance needs as well as the portfolio risk in the region have exploded. As a result, shareholders just agreed to a 4 billion euro capital increase in December of last year. It's the only institution other than the IDB Invest where a general capital increase has been agreed. So somewhat ironically, an institution which originally had a temporary mandate at the end of the Cold War is now heavily involved for the foreseeable future in two new parts of the world that are engulfed in new wars.
Yeah, I mean, all I can say is it's sure good the EBRD was not closed down in 2008, and it's still there to help. So we've learned about these RDBs, and we've learned about what they do, and it's important to see how they fit into the wider institutional cooperative framework, I think. We learned how they collaborate with the IMF and IBRD when a member country faces debt crises and debt distress. Are there other recent examples of enhanced collaboration among the RDBs? You mentioned a couple in passing, but are there some others you'd like to highlight?
Well, we should think of the MDBs collectively as a global asset. But the world could extract, I think, much more value from that asset if the institutions collaborated systematically with each other. Strengthening the functions of the MDBs as a system has long been on the reform agenda, including in the G20. But unfortunately, there has been very little progress. But I'm happy to report that that has recently begun to change. That's in part due to the capital adequacy report submitted to the G20 in 2022. I was a member of the panel that produced that report, and we deliberately focused on reforms applicable across the system to increase overall MDB finance capability. So people can now see how much finance MDBs could provide collectively, whereas before there was only a focus on each institution's individual lending. We can no longer afford a fragmented approach in a world where annual finance gaps for development and climate investments are in the trillions. Fortunately, we have a new set of MDB heads that get the urgency of this moment and are publicly embracing collaboration. In October, they released a statement that commits to boost joint action on climate, collaborate better at the country level, co-finance more, and work together to mobilize private finance. So I hope in some future podcast, we'll be exploring the progress made by the MDBs as a system. After all, collective action is a bedrock principle of multilateralism, and it doesn't only apply to governments. It applies just as much, if not more, to the multilateral development institutions that we need to help with the climate, health, and other problems that can only be solved collectively.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for this wonderful exploration of a number of key regional development banks and giving us a sense of why they were created, what they do within the wider ecosystem of development finance and assistance. One thing we could see in this review of regional banks is that they are indeed created by governments, and as we could see at their foundations and as they evolved, that they are indeed political institutions. However, their multilateral character does make their development activities somewhat less likely to be dominated by one single political point of view or bias, and hopefully create more objective decision-making and better results. In our next podcast, we're going to be looking at the regional development banks with a particular focus on Asia. First, with the last of the four legacy RDBs, the Asian Development Bank, and then considering the two newest development banks, the New Development Bank and the Asian Infrastructure Bank, in which China had an important founding role. Please continue with us on the journey. Meanwhile, please share these podcasts with others who may find them interesting and informative. Nancy, thank you again for participating.
My pleasure. Thanks, Nancy.